Chapter 5. For instance, a specially awkward turn of the Congo between Kinshasa and Leopoldsville, more particularly when one had to take it at night in a big canoe with only half the proper number of paddlers. I failed in being the second white man on record drowned at that interesting spot through the upsetting of a canoe. The first was a young Belgian officer, but the accident happened some months before my time, and he too, I believe, was going home. Not perhaps quite so ill as myself, but still he was going home. I got round the turn more or less alive, though I was too sick to care whether I did or not, and, always with Almayer's folly amongst my diminishing baggage, I arrived at that delectable capital Boma, where before the departure of the steamer which was to take me home I had the time to wish myself dead over and over again with perfect sincerity. At that date there were in existence only 7 chapters of Almayer's Folly, but the chapter in my history which followed was that of a long, long illness and very dismal convalescence. Geneva, or more precisely the hydropathic establishment of Champel, is rendered forever famous by the termination of the 8th chapter in the history of Almayer's decline and fall. The events of the 9th are inextricably mixed up with the details of the proper management of a waterside warehouse owned by a certain city firm whose name does not matter. But that work, undertaken to accustom myself again to the activities of a healthy existence, soon came to an end. The earth had nothing to hold me with for very long. And then that memorable story, like a cask of choice Madeira, got carried for 3 years to and fro upon the sea. Whether this treatment improved its flavor or not, of course I would not like to say. As far as appearances concerned, it certainly did nothing of the kind. The whole MS acquired a faded look and an ancient, yellowish complexion. It became at last unreasonable to suppose that anything in the world would ever happen to Almayer and Nina. And yet something most unlikely to happen on the high seas was to wake them up from their state of suspended animation. What is it that novelist says? T is certain my conviction gains infinitely the moment another soul will believe in it. And what is a novel, if not a conviction of our fellow men's existence strong enough to take upon itself a form of imagined life clearer than reality, and whose accumulated verisimilitude of selected episodes puts to shame the pride of documentary history. Providence which saved my MS from the Congo Rapids brought it to the knowledge of a helpful soul far out on the open sea. It would be on my part the greatest ingratitude ever to forget the sallow, sunken face and the deep-set, dark eyes of the young Cambridge man. He was a passenger for his health on board the good ship Torrens outward bound to Australia, who was the first reader of Almayer's Folly, the very first reader I ever had. Would it bore you very much reading AMS in a handwriting like mine? I asked him one evening on a sudden impulse at the end of a longish conversation whose subject was Gibbon's history. Jacques, that was his name, was sitting in my cabin one stormy dog watch below, after bringing me a book to read from his own traveling store. "Not at all," he answered with his courteous intonation and a faint smile. As I pulled a drawer open, his suddenly aroused curiosity gave him a watchful expression. I wonder what he expected to see. A poem, maybe. All that's beyond guessing now. He was not a cold, but a calm man, still more subdued by disease, a man of few words, and of an unassuming modesty in general intercourse, but with something uncommon in the whole of his person which set him apart from the undistinguished lot of our 60 passengers. His eyes had a thoughtful, introspective look. In his attractive, reserved manner, and in a veiled, sympathetic voice, he asked, "What is this?" "T is a sort of tale," I answered with an effort. "T is not even finished yet. Nevertheless, I would like to know what you think of it." He put the MS in the breast pocket of his jacket. I remember perfectly his thin brown fingers folding it lengthwise. "We'll read it tomorrow," he remarked, seizing the door handle, and then, watching the roll of the ship for a propitious moment, he opened the door and was gone. In the moment of his exit, I heard the sustained booming of the wind, the swish of the water on the decks of the Torrens, and the subdued, as if distant, roar of the rising sea. I noted the growing disquiet in the great restlessness of the ocean, and responded professionally to it with the thought that at 8 o'clock, in another half hour or so at the furthest, the topgallant sails would have to come off the ship. Next day, but this time in the first dog watch, Jacques entered my cabin. He had a thick, woolen muffler round his throat and the MS was in his hand. He tendered it to me with a steady look, but without a word. I took it in silence. He sat down on the couch and still said nothing. I opened and shut a drawer under my desk, on which a filled-up log slate lay wide open in its wooden frame waiting to be copied neatly into the sort of book I was accustomed to write with care, the ship's logbook. I turned my back squarely on the desk. And even then Jacques never offered a word. "L, what do you say?" I asked at last. "Is it worth finishing?" This question expressed exactly the whole of my thoughts. Distinctly, he answered in his sedate, veiled voice and then coughed a little. "Were you interested?" I inquired further almost in a whisper. "Very much." In a pause I went on meeting instinctively the heavy rolling of the ship, and Jacques put his feet upon the couch. The curtain of my bed place swung to and fro as it were a punka, the bulkhead lamp circled in its gimbals, and now and then the cabin door rattled slightly in the gusts of wind. It was in latitude 40 south, and nearly in the longitude of Greenwich, as far as I can remember, that these quiet rites of Almayer's and Nina's resurrection were taking place. In the prolonged silence it occurred to me that there was a good deal of retrospective writing in the story as far as it went. Was it intelligible in its action, I asked myself, as if already the storyteller were being born into the body of a seaman. But I heard on deck the whistle of the officer of the watch, and remained on the alert to catch the order that was to follow this call to attention. It reached me as a faint, fierce shout to square the yards. "Aha!" I thought to myself, a westerly blow coming on. Then I turned to my very first reader who, alas, was not to live long enough to know the end of the tale. Now let me ask you one more thing. Is the story quite clear to you as it stands? He raised his dark, gentle eyes to my face and seemed surprised. "Yes, perfectly." This was all I was to hear from his lips concerning the merits of Almayer's Folly. We never spoke together of the book again. A long period of bad weather set in, and I had no thoughts left but for my duties, whilst poor Jacques caught a fatal cold and had to keep close in his cabin. When we arrived in Adelaide, the first reader of my prose went at once up country and died rather suddenly in the end, either in Australia or it may be on the passage while going home through the Suez Canal. I am not sure which it was now, and I do not think I ever heard precisely, though I made inquiries about him from some of our return passengers who, wandering about to the country during the ship's stay in port, had come upon him here and there. At last we sailed, homeward bound, and still not one line was added to the careless scrawl of the many pages which poor Jacques had the patience to read with the very shadows of eternity gathering already in the hollows of his kind, steadfast eyes. The purpose instilled into me by his simple and final distinctly remained dormant, yet alive to await its opportunity. I dare say I am compelled, unconsciously compelled, now to write volume after volume, as in past years I was compelled to go to sea voyage after voyage. Leaves must follow upon each other as leaks used to follow in the days gone by, on, and on to the appointed end, which, being truth itself, is one for all men and for all occupations. I do not know which of the two impulses has appeared more mysterious and more wonderful to me. Still, in writing, as in going to sea, I had to wait my opportunity. Let me confess here that I was never one of those wonderful fellows that would go afloat in a wash tub for the sake of the fun, and if I may pride myself upon my consistency, it was ever just the same with my writing. Some men, I have heard, ride in railway carriages, and could do it, perhaps, sitting cross-legged on a clothesline. But I must confess that my sybaritic disposition will not consent to write without something at least resembling a chair. Line by line, rather than page by page, was the growth of Lemaire's folly. And so it happened that I very nearly lost the MS. Advance now to the first words of the ninth chapter, in the Friedrichstrasse railway station that's in Berlin, you know, on my way to Poland, or more precisely to Ukraine. On an early sleepy morning changing trains in a hurry I left my Gladstone bag in the refreshment room. A worthy and intelligent coffer-trager rescued it. Yet in my anxiety I was not thinking of the MS, but of all the other things that were packed in the bag. In Warsaw, where I spent 2 days, those wandering pages were never exposed to the light, except once, to candlelight, while the bag lay open on a chair. I was dressing hurriedly, to dine at a sporting club. A friend of my childhood, he had been in the diplomatic service, but had turned to growing wheat on paternal acres, and we had not seen each other for over 20 years, was sitting on the hotel sofa waiting to carry me off there. "You might tell me something of your life while you are dressing," he suggested kindly. I do not think I told him much of my life story either then or later. The talk of the select little party with which he made me dine was extremely animated, and embraced most subjects under heaven, from big game shooting in Africa to the last poem published in a very modernist review, edited by the very young, and patronized by the highest society. But it never touched upon Almayer's folly, and next morning, in uninterrupted obscurity, this inseparable companion went on rolling with me in the southeast direction towards the government of Kiev. At that time there was an 8 hours drive, if not more, from the railway station to the country house which was my destination. "Dear boy," these words were always written in English, so ran the last letter from that house received in London, "at yourself driven to the only inn in the place, dine as well as you can, and sometime in the evening my own confidential servant, factotum and major domo, a Mr. V. SS, I warn you he is of noble extraction, will present himself before you, reporting the arrival of the small sledge which will take you here on the next day. I send with him my heaviest fur, which I suppose with such overcoats as you may have with you will keep you from freezing on the road." Sure enough, as I was dining, served by a Hebrew waiter, in an enormous barn-like bedroom with a freshly painted floor, the door opened, and, in a traveling costume of long boots, big sheepskin cap and a short coat girt with a leather belt, the Mr. V. SS, of noble extraction, a man of about 35, appeared with an air of perplexity on his open and mustachioed countenance. I got up from the table, and greeted him in Polish, with, I hope, the right shade of consideration demanded by his noble blood and his confidential position. His face cleared up in a wonderful way. It appeared that, notwithstanding my uncle's earnest assurances, the good fellow had remained in doubt of our understanding each other. He imagined I would talk to him in some foreign language. I was told that his last words on getting into the sledge, to come to meet me, shaped an anxious exclamation. "Well, well, here I am going, but God only knows how I am to make myself understood to our master's nephew." We understood each other very well from the first. He took charge of me, as if I were not quite of age. I had a delightful boyish feeling of coming home from school, when he muffled me up next morning in an enormous bearskin traveling coat, and took his seat protectively by my side. The sledge was a very small one, and it looked utterly insignificant, almost like a toy behind the four big bays, harnessed two and two. We three, counting the coachman, filled it completely. He was a young fellow with clear blue eyes. The high collar of his livery fur coat framed his cheery countenance, and stood all round level with the top of his head. "Now, Joseph," my companion addressed him, "do you think we shall manage to get home before six?" His answer was that we would surely, with God's help, and providing there were no heavy drifts in the long stretch between certain villages whose names came with an extremely familiar sound to my ears. He turned out an excellent coachman with an instinct for keeping the road amongst the snow-covered fields, and a natural gift of getting the best out of his horses. He is the son of that Joseph, that I suppose the captain remembers. He who used to drive the captain's late grandmother of holy memory, remarked V.S.S. busy tucking fur rugs about my feet. I remembered perfectly the trusty Joseph who used to drive my grandmother. Why? He it was who let me hold the reins for the first time in my life, and allowed me to play with the great four-in-hand whip outside the doors of the coach house. What became of him? I asked. He is no longer serving, I suppose. He served our master, was the reply. But he died of cholera 10 years ago now, that great epidemic we had. And his wife died at the same time, the whole houseful of them, and this is the only boy that was left. The MS. of Mayor's Folly was reposing in the bag under our feet. I saw again the sun setting on the plains as I saw it in the travels of my childhood. It set, clear and red, dipping into the snow in full view, as if it were setting on the sea. It was 23 years since I had seen the sun set over that land, and we drove on in the darkness which fell swiftly upon the livid expanse of snows till, out of the waste of a white earth joining a bestered sky, surged up black shapes, the clumps of trees about a village of the Ukrainian plain. A cottage or two glided by, a low interminable wall, and then, glimmering and winking through a screen of fir trees, the lights of the master's house. That very evening the wandering MS. of Mayor's Folly was unpacked, and unostentatiously laid on the writing table in my room, the guest room which had been, I was informed in an affectedly careless tone, awaiting me for some 15 years or so. It attracted no attention from the affectionate presence hovering round the son of the favorite sister. You won't have many hours to yourself while you are staying with me, brother, he said, this form of address borrowed from the speech of our peasants, being the usual expression of the highest good humor in a moment of affectionate elation. She'll be always coming in for a chat. As a matter of fact, we had the whole house to chat in, and were everlastingly intruding upon each other. I invaded the retirement of his study, where the principal feature was a colossal silver inkstand presented to him on his 50th year by Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.